You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, compassion training for parents could have a number of positive impacts on their kids, including less stress throughout their kids' lives. A Wisconsin researcher tells us more. Now, President Trump was in Wisconsin last night for a campaign rally at UW-Milwaukee's Panther Arena. He talked to thousands of supporters about things like the new NAFTA deal and the upcoming impeachment trial. And he praised the state's economy, giving Wisconsin Republicans credit for the state's low unemployment numbers. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was there for the rally. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Set the scene for us, Craig. What was the crowd like? What was the mood?
Well, it was a big, kind of buoyant crowd. I mean, the people that he attracts to these rallies are really, really kind of passionate about President Trump, except for the handful of protesters, which is also sort of part of the theater at these rallies. And just, you know, a really kind of big moment in time in politics and a venue that is kind of at the epicenter of this election in many ways. You know, Milwaukee with all the symbolism of being the host city of the Democratic Convention and the biggest city in what a lot of people think is the most important state in this election, and a very Democratic city and a Republican president coming into that city and holding one of his kind of trademark kind of rowdy rallies.
Let's give a listen to President Trump from early in the rally saying he's delivered on his campaign promises.
I said, I'm going to do this. We're going to take care of your trade. What we've done with China now on Wednesday, we signed. That's tomorrow. What we've done with the USMCA. What we've done with Japan, $40 billion trade deal. That a lot of it has to do with the farmers. South Korea. Oh, you got to love Trump. You got to love Trump.
Was that specific messaging there to Wisconsin voters mentioning the farmers there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there were some Wisconsin touches. I mean, you asked me to set the scene. I mean, there's several really distinctive things about these rallies. One is the length. I mean, they're really long. I mean, he went on for close to an hour and a half. And then he's sort of moving back and forth between just sort of ad-libbing and kind of shtick and stand-up and a script. And it's kind of an oddly jarring shifting back and forth between those two. And, you know, he knows how to play to the crowd, but he also in some ways kind of tests their endurance because he goes on for so long. There were a lot of Wisconsin touches. I mean, the obligatory nods to the Packers, to Aaron Rodgers. He brought up the Wisconsin Republican congressional delegation. He had Ron Johnson kind of speak in the middle of the rally on his behalf. I think everybody gets it who comes to these rallies that, you know, that their state is really critical and Donald Trump is going to, you know, is going to campaign really hard for their votes.
And there's an extended riff on dishes and dishwashers. Is that right?
Dishes,
and other appliances?
Yeah. Light bulbs and dishwashers and dishes and shampooing. And, there's always like a bunch of, you know, this kind of, I guess, falls into the category, depending on your point of view, of color or just weirdness. In terms of, you know, his riffing, and we got, he was kind of jokingly complaining about, environmental rules that, you know, restrict the amount of water you can use in your dishwasher and how it's not going to get your dishes clean, and he's going to take care of that, and light bulb mandates that, you know, he's going to get rid of the environmentally sustainable light bulbs that make your skin look orange, which is also kind of an inside joke for President Trump. So there was a lot of that kind of banter during the evening, along with, you know, his sort of trademark attacks on, you know, Democrats from live Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and then dead Democrats like Lyndon Johnson.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at President Trump's rally in Milwaukee last night and Wisconsin's role in the presidential election in 2020. Let's turn to that now, Craig. Wisconsin, you already mentioned it, the president coming here. We've got the Democratic Convention coming to Milwaukee as well. Like it or not, we're going to be getting a lot of attention this year, aren't we?
Yeah, it, you know, it reminds me in some ways of 2004 when we were about as targeted as a state could possibly be by both presidential campaigns. I mean, they were here all the time. They were crisscrossing the state in buses. I don't think they'll be campaigning quite at that retail level, but certainly President Trump will be here a lot, and Democrats don't want to repeat and have vowed not to repeat the mistake that Hillary Clinton made of not coming here last time around. So, yeah, we're very much at the epicenter. I think people get that. I mean, we'll be lavished with not only with media attention, with digital and television and radio advertising, and a lot of just, you know, nuts and bolts organizing, knocking on doors, social media organizing. It's going to be, I mean, both sides are going to leave no stones unturned. And I think that drives up turnout in several ways. Both the sheer awareness of the importance of the state, I think, drives up turnout, and also just the actual mechanics of getting of these get out the vote, these field operations, gets people to the polls. It mobilizes people.
You spend a lot of time looking at polls, and you have gone around the state talking to people. Are there a lot of people whose minds are going to be changed from Democrat to Republican or vice versa? Or is it, as you were just saying, it's all about getting people to turn out, the people who might be on the fence about voting at all
out? You know, it's both. I mean, you have to say there aren't a lot of people who are in play and who are persuadable. But part of, you know, being in play is just whether you vote or not. It's not just who you vote for. And so, you know, it's sort of persuasion bleeds over into mobilization when you think about, I mean, you have to get people to want to vote for you, but you also have to get them to vote, to want to vote. And, you know, I talked to so many people about 2016 who told me that they went into the voting booth not knowing how they were going to vote, or they went into the voting booth not liking the vote that they knew they were going to cast, whichever vote it was that they were going to cast. I mean, people were really unhappy with their choices, a lot of people. And that was part of the unpredictability of that election. I think we could see some of that again in 2020 easily.
We heard from Matt in Evansville, who says you can't spell win without W-I. That's probably true in 2020. Let's bring out a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I was watching today that the impeachment passed in the House of Representatives, and I was wondering if the guests would comment. I mean, in general, Trump has been going through the impeachment process since he was elected. Do you think the actual impeachment will actually affect the election, or are people so, you know, dulled by what has been going on and the criticism of him that it'll just be tossed aside as just another aspect of the politics that we're dealing with now?
Charlie, thanks. What do we know from polling, Craig, on whether impeachment is affecting President Trump?
Well, so there was just actual a poll out today by Marquette, a statewide poll. And when they asked people, I hope I'm getting this right because it's from memory, but when they asked people whether they approved of the House vote to impeach President Trump, it was something like 47% approved and 49% disapproved, which is basically 50-50, reflecting the pretty 50-50 divisions over President Trump when you look at his approval rating and also when you look at his head-to-head matchups with the leading Democrats in a November matchup. So, and if you ask them whether they think president should be convicted in the Senate, there's a little less support than there was for the House vote for impeachment. It's something like, you know, 47% or 49% against conviction and 42 or 43% for conviction. So it's very divisive and people are fairly evenly divided, but there's certainly not majority support for removing President Trump. And, you know, that's kind of where we are. So I think if it had an effect, it's going to have an effect on the margins. And of course, the margins will matter.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Craig, as we wrap up, what are you going to be watching for between now and November as this election shakes out?
Well, I'll be looking at, you know, at the map. You know, there are a lot of really important dynamics when it comes to different parts of the state, and people are familiar with them by now. I mean, is Milwaukee going to turn out in large enough numbers for Democrats? Is President Trump, who underperformed kind of typical Republican levels in the Republican suburbs around Milwaukee, will that happen again, or can he bring those voters back? You know, can he replicate what was a stunning performance in small towns and in northern and western Wisconsin. So I'll be looking at the map. I'll be looking at some of the demographics. I'll be looking at the signs for turnout. I mean, I think we could have an historic turnout, but there will be indicators along the way. And I'm just really curious how, again, using some 2000 and 2004 as touchstones, where we had really furious contest for the state, I'll be looking to for a repeat of that, but I think it's going to, you know, I'm looking how it differs from the way they fought for the state in those elections, too.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert, political reporter and Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us today to break down what we saw yesterday at President Trump's campaign rally in Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll talk to players for both of Wisconsin's power wheelchair soccer teams. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is home to a pair of power soccer teams. That's a sport played on wheelchair. We'll talk to a player from each about their sport and a tournament coming up this weekend. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about encountering a stranger on a snowy road.
Driving home on a snowy Wisconsin night, author Crystal Chan and her mother encountered a hitchhiker in the blowing snow. The question of whether to pick him up or not led her to explore the meaning and limits of compassion. She brings us the story.
It was a bad snowstorm, the kind that wipes out your vision, erases the world, and makes you break for a red light a full city block before you come to the intersection. It was nighttime, and my mom and I were in the car heading home over the viaduct on 20th Avenue in Oshkosh. The radio was off as my mom handled the vehicle on the heavy, slippery roads. That was when we saw him, a figure, hunched over, walking on the sidewalk on that viaduct in full blast of the winter storm. In fact, because of the storm, we almost didn't see him. What could he possibly be doing in a storm like this? I asked my mom. I don't know, she said. He trudged along. We inched along. Mom paused. Should we pick him up? I was surprised at her question. There are dangers out there, murderers and rapists and thieves. There we were, two women in a car in a snowstorm, the heater blazing. There he was, a young man, hunched over into the blinding winds, almost disappeared from view. You couldn't help but feel for him. I'd never picked up anyone before. I had a good hunch that my mom hadn't either. Yeah, I said. Let's pick him up. I rolled down my window. Hey, where are you going? I asked. He told us. The location was halfway across town. In the darkness, I looked at Mom and she looked at me. I looked back at him. Come on in if you want, I said. We'll take you there. We rolled to a slow stop, and he opened the door to the back seat. A blast of cold air followed him in. We asked him some general questions, but he didn't say much, so we crawled through town in silence. I was sweating under my winter coat. He is in our car, I thought. I cannot believe we actually picked up a stranger. Mom gripped the steering wheel with both hands. The man spoke only to give us directions to the house, and when we pulled alongside it, he thanked us twice, then got out. As soon as he left, it was as if a sudden storm had lifted, even though it was still snowing. We turned around and crawled our slow way home, both deeply shaken, both deeply pleased. It's easy to say that compassion is a good thing. It's much harder to live it out, especially when you need to weigh things like risk and danger and fear. Mom and I both agreed that had we been the only one in the car, we would have kept driving. If there had been two men walking, we would have kept driving, and so forth. There are no easy answers, and I've messed up this equation more times than I'd like, preferring the route of safety to the route of lived-out compassion. But in extending that gesture of decency, somehow I felt more human in the process, more connected, less alone. It can be mysterious how compassion works and how the strangest gifts can come in the strangest packaging in a snowstorm on a cold winter night.
Crystal Chan is a storyteller and author based in Chicago. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, power soccer may not be a household phrase, but organized power chair soccer, a sport for people who use power wheelchairs, has actually been played for decades. Wisconsin fields two power soccer teams, the Chippewa Valley Hooligans and the Wisconsin Warriors, based in Madison. Both of those teams are going to participate in a tournament this weekend in Sun Prairie. A player from each team joins us now. Ryan Nell plays for the Warriors. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jason Endres is a player and coach for Chippewa Valley. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Ryan, can you start us off for people who haven't been to a power soccer match? Paint us a picture of what the play looks like.
Well, we play on a regulation size basketball court, and we play 4-on-4, so 3 forwards and a goalie for each team, and we use a ball that's that's the same material as a standard soccer ball, but approximately 3 times the size.
And Jason, what got you into the game?
What got me into the game is that we had a member that played in Minnesota, and he wanted to start a team here in Eau Claire, Colin Connolly. And so he decided to start this team, and we all went to an informational meeting, and we got into a soccer chair, and I was hooked ever since.
And what's your origin in the game, Ryan?
So I started playing for the Wisconsin Warriors about halfway through the season three years ago. So I'm in my third season now. And my good buddy Bill is the coach of the team, and we've been friends for well over 20 years. And he told me for a long while that I just needed to come and check out a practice. And so I finally did that. And much like Jason, I was there for about, I don't know, probably about 5 minutes, and I was like, how do I do this? What do I need to do? Who do I give my money to? Where do I get a chair? You know, that kind of thing. So it was sort of an instant obsession for me.
And Jason, I understand players on the teams, and these are teams around the country, there's men and women, a wide variety of ages as well. Can you talk about kind of the variety of people participating in power soccer?
Oh, yeah. I can tell you just on our team, my wife and I are in our 40s. And our youngest player is 13, so a wide variety. There is a team in Illinois that a grandmother was playing, and she was wanting to retire, but she couldn't retire because her grandson that was 5, he wanted to play with her for 1 year. So before she retired, they got to play for a year together.
And Ryan, you play teams from around the country. Are you meeting friends and developing rivalries with players around the country along the way?
Oh, certainly. So we have a national tournament in June that we play in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And the last 2 years, we have been eliminated by the same team in the tournament both times. And so, you know, we have a good camaraderie with all the teams, and that's one of the things I really love about power soccer, is everybody is very friendly, and we all become very close. You know, comparative to able-bodied sports, it's a pretty small population, so we all get to know each other pretty well for the most part. But, yeah, still very fiercely competitive on the floor, and, you know, always looking for ways to, you know, get an edge over our competitors. So, yeah. But I would definitely say that we have certain teams that we look forward to competing with every season, and we have certain teams that are sort of our nemesis in that we have trouble beating them, and so we definitely develop specific strategies and things like that. So, yeah, a very healthy competition.
And, Jason, both of your teams, you're actually going to play each other, the Chippewa Valley team and the Wisconsin Warriors team, in this second annual Spin Kick Classic Power Soccer Tournament. That's this weekend in Sun Prairie. What's this event going to be like, Jason?
Oh, it's going to be cool. It's going to be 4 teams total, one from Minnesota, us two, in Wisconsin, and there's going to be a Chicago team. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Like Ryan said, we're all friends. And, you know, this year it's fun that Hooligans and Madison Warriors are all in the same division. So when we get to Fort Wayne in June, we're both going to fight for the cup.
Let's bring on a caller. Jamie is on the line in Viroqua. Jamie, hi.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I just wanted to say my nephew plays it in Sacramento, and I will actually be in Fort Wayne, Indiana this summer to watch him, to root him on.
Fantastic, Jamie. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I wanted to ask Ryan, are spectators welcome at these tournaments?
Oh, certainly welcome and encouraged to be there. As a player personally, I really like to have a loud, sort of electric, exciting environment. So, you know, for me, the more people that can be there, the better. And bring your noisemakers, bring your drums, bring your horns, bring whatever noisemakers you want to bring. We like to make it very exciting.
And Jason, for people out there listening who use wheelchairs themselves, would you encourage them to give the sport a try?
I would certainly, you know, any kind of ability that is out there, if you can only use your finger to control your chair or your foot to control your chair, anyone can play the powered wheelchair soccer.
Best of luck to both of you this weekend. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ryan, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing your time.
That's Ryan Nell with the Wisconsin Warriors power soccer team and Jason Endres with the Chippewa Valley Hooligans. We talked to them today about the sport of power soccer and this tournament they have coming up this weekend in Sun Prairie. Coming up, new research finds that parents who receive compassion training can help reduce stress in their children, and that in turn can have a profound effect throughout their lives. A Wisconsin researcher joins the show to tell us more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at big legal and criminal justice issues here in the state, from sex trafficking to a court case on Wisconsin's voter rolls. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there's an increased interest in the field of psychology about the impact that compassion can have on our mental and physical well-being. Compassion and compassion training are part of the growing field of mindfulness, which includes practices like meditation. Recently, researchers looked at the role compassion training played for parents and children. The results found that parents who received compassion training had children who had lower levels of some stress hormones. Our next guest joins us to talk about that study and the long-term impact that compassion can have on stress levels in kids and the rest of us. Julie Pailman-Tynan is the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology at the UW-Madison. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Before we dig into the specific research, this concept of compassion training, we can be trained in compassion, where you might think, I'm either compassionate or I'm not. Talk about what this training involves.
Right. Well, a lot of times we think that people are just born with empathy and compassion, but we're not born with all the language we need. We're not born with all the motor skills we need. And we learn those things. People teach us, and we see those things increase over time. The same thing is true with empathy and compassion, that if you don't teach it to children, it kind of increases in them, plateaus. But if you engage in training of compassion and empathy, you can see that continue to increase throughout the lifespan.
Do we tend to have at least some level of compassion kind of, built in, hardwired into us even before that training? Do when we look at, I guess, infants and toddlers, do they have some of that compassion?
Oh, absolutely. They start off in life with having some ability to feel what others feel, read faces, experience other people's emotions. And their tendency is to engage in some pro-social behavior. But as I said, if that's just kind of left, it plateaus.
We'll dig into a little more about how this compassion training might work, but let's get into the research that you worked on here. What did you do?
So we took a program called Cognitively Based Compassion Training, and for the first time, we looked at how that affected parents of infants and young children. It had been used with other people before. It was developed for college students to help decrease their stress, but it's also been used in people with breast cancer and other medical populations, and even adapted for children in foster care. But it was the first time anyone's tried it with parents of infants and young children, and then also looked at not only the stress of the people taking the training, but also their children, who really didn't get any direct intervention at all.
You had a control group, I understand, of parents who didn't get this compassion training and parents who did. Let's look at some of the results now. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, well, we looked at a number of different things because stress is one of those things. You can feel it in your body. So we looked at physiological stress. That is, we measured cortisol, which is a stress hormone. And then we also looked at parents' reports of their stress. So how they feel stress in their body, how they perceive that, but also parenting stress, because it's kind of a natural thing for parents to feel stressed out. I know you're a parent. I'm a parent. Mm-hmm.
There's some stress that comes with the territory.
Absolutely. But chronic stress can be really problematic, especially when it's high, and that can affect children. So we measured a number of different things in the study, including the parents' stress, but also the children's physiological stress. And we did that by taking samples of hair. It's very non-intrusive for little kids, and it gives us like a cumulative look at how stressed they are over a period of months.
And so you found out the kids of the parents who got this compassion training, what kind of things did we learn about them?
Yeah, we found out that the kids had a decrease in stress when their parents were in the compassion training. So that means that by the time the parents were finished with this program, their children actually showed less cortisol in their body that was accumulated over time. Now, the parents did not show less cortisol. It's actually kind of hard to move parents' cortisol because they're adults, where as very young children, it's kind of easier to move that. But we did see a decrease in parenting stress that the parents reported if it started at a really high or what we call a clinical level. And then we saw a decrease over time.
But for the kids, their cortisol levels went down after their parents got this training, if I have that right.
Yes, absolutely.
And hammering home what a big deal this is. We hear more and more about research, and we've talked to UW's Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria about the impacts, the physical, the mental health impacts of long-term elevated levels of stress hormones like cortisol. There's a lot at stake here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why we were so excited about this finding, that by doing an intervention with parents focusing on compassion, that we actually saw some movement in a children's cortisol. Now, everybody experiences some stress. Obviously, you know, babies and young children experience stress when they're hungry or if they fall down or if they're separated briefly from a caregiver. But we're talking here about the impacts of toxic stress or long-term intense kinds of stress when a child, for example, lives in poverty or they experience really negative interactions with their caregivers. Now, when stress continues, when cortisol stays raised in a child's body, it can have effects on not only the bodily functions like susceptibility to disease, but it can also affect the structure and function of their brain. And it can really reset their self-regulation system that can have very long-term implications.
Talking to Julie Palman-Tynan, professor of human ecology at UW-Madison, looking at the impact of compassion training for parents, how it can help their kids avoid levels of toxic stress that could affect them for a very long time. Julie, let's talk about what this compassion training looks like, because I think a lot of people might be interested in checking this out, parents or not. How does one train in compassion?
Right, right. Well, there are a number of different ways, but as I mentioned before, we used a specific program called Cognitively Based Compassion Training, and it was developed at Emory University, and it involves like 8 different modules. It's usually about 20 hours of training, and it takes people from initially focusing on mindfulness to cultivate attentional stability so they can really start to focus on some things. Then it goes into focusing on self-compassion. And it's kind of interesting because sometimes people find it difficult to distinguish between self-compassion and like selfishness, or, you know, people think parenting always involves self-sacrifice, but being really compassionate to oneself, treating oneself like a friend, is really important. Then the program moves on to talk about extending that, the feelings of compassion from the self to then people they care about, and then also to people they don't even know. And it focuses both on feelings related to compassion, what we call aspirational compassion, meaning we want to help people who are suffering. We want to decrease that, but also then moves into enacted compassion. How do we actually do that in our lives? And parents often can start with their own kids and show them compassion, but then also model compassion to anybody in their lives.
Were you able to observe in your research how that parent who went through the compassion training parented differently, acted differently to and around their kids?
Well, we heard from the parents in the groups what they felt they were doing differently. So they often talked about that if they were in a really stressful situation, like they were late for something, they had to get the child ready for childcare, their child was crying, everything was kind of a mess, how they could focus and calm themselves and act in a compassionate way to the child instead of acting frustrated or critical. In our work, we did observe parents interacting with children in the lab setting, but we didn't get a chance to observe them in their naturalistic settings. We heard from them that they were maybe doing things differently.
Are you looking to expand this now and figure out how to make it an operational level thing? I mean, it's a very expensive to treat the consequences and painful to treat the consequences of long-term stress, toxic stress, and trauma. This comparatively sounds like a very cheap intervention to prevent that happening in the first place. How can you expand from this research to something more people can use?
Yeah, we are working on that now. I mean, one of the goals of doing this, we started off doing it with sort of a low-risk sample, and one of the goals is to expand it to many children who experience lots of risks, including their parents. And so we do agree that it's a way better approach to try to prevent these things before they become really severe. And so we're working on that now. I mean, research is one of those things that can take a really long time. But we are working on expanding access to compassion training for people who even experience lots of different risks and stressors.
We're talking to Julie Pailman-Tynan, professor of human ecology at UW-Madison. She's with us to talk about her recent study looking at the role compassion training can have for parents and their kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this idea of compassion training if you're a parent and have tried to be more compassionate with your kids? Have you seen an impact? Have you done some kind of compassion training yourself? Or there's a thing called compassion meditation, I think, maybe you've done. I'd love to hear about your experiences with that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about compassion, parents, and childhood stress with Julie Pailman-Tynan, professor of human ecology at UW-Madison. She recently conducted a study that looks at the impact that compassion training can have on parents and their kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about compassion and compassion training? What role do you think that can have on our well-being? If you're a parent, do you have questions about how this worked in this study, how it might apply maybe to you? Have you done some kind of compassion training yourself, taken it or administered it? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Haley is with us in Oakdale. Haley, hi.
Hi. I had a question just really defining compassion and looking at it through a parent's view. I think we can often like define it in many different ways. So I'm just curious if like there's a way that the guests could maybe talk about how parents are like better able to display that compassion to their children and what that kind of looks like just in everyday life. Because I think sometimes we just picture compassion as, you know, generally speaking, being nice to someone, but maybe going into more detail about that.
Haley, thanks. Yeah, what we can think of as a vague concept in day-to-day terms.
Right. And I think it's an excellent point to say that compassion can come in so many endless forms. And some examples of how parents can be compassionate to their children in everyday life is that when you see a child crying or exhibiting some kind of distress or fear, to really try to think of that as communication and think of, well, what is my child trying to express to me? And taking a breath and pausing to think about that instead of just reacting. Because as parents, we often find ourselves in stressful situations and we sometimes just want our kids to cooperate and be quiet and be happy. But sometimes it really does take that extra pause, kind of take a breath, think about what is my child trying to communicate to me and how can I help reduce their suffering in order to meet their needs.
Haley, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Donna with us in Brookfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a special ed teacher, and this training sounds very interesting. I'm wondering if there's any plans to offer it to special education teachers. I think I'm a pretty compassionate person, but there's probably always something more to learn.
Donna, thanks. Yeah, teachers, do you think they could benefit from this?
Absolutely. I think really anyone who works with children or people in general can benefit from it. And the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison has a program called the Kindness Curriculum that they use working with schools. And even though it's not compassion training per se, it uses some of the principles of mindfulness to help kids and to help teachers deal with the stressful situations that can arise in the classroom. And in a previous study I did, we used the kindness curriculum with low-income preschoolers, and we found it really helped the kids' self-regulation and it helped the teachers as well.
Thanks so much for that call, Donna, at 800-642-1234. As we talk about compassion and compassion training with Julie Pailman-Tynan from UW-Madison, I want to get into the nuts and bolts of how this works now, this compassion training, a little more. And I used the phrase compassion meditation earlier, and I think you mentioned the Center for Healthy Minds, Richard Davidson from that center actually demonstrated compassion meditation on the show here a few years back. Talk us through how that works.
Yeah. So cognitively based compassion training is based on a Tibetan Buddhism concept called Lojong, which means mind training, but it's a secular version or non-religious version of that. And so what people do is in the training, the instructors take people through guided meditations to really focus on becoming aware of their feelings and their attitudes, and then being able to sort of dive in and think of, like, if they can extend compassion to themselves, how can they also extend those same feelings to people around them? And the homework for the training involves guided meditations at home, doing them even daily, and then practicing with their children and other people in their lives, how they can respond and show that empathy and compassion to people around them. So it really is a meditation-based training.
And it sounds like it is practicing for that stressful situation, the crying kid example. I think a lot of us have had, in whatever kind of situation, we have that instant reaction, which is not always the best one. It's maybe a negative reaction, just being able to train our brains to pause and take a deeper look.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we're presented with a child who's frustrated or angry or crying or distressed or afraid, it actually triggers the parent to have a stress reaction. And so when the parent is able to kind of calm down and focus on regulating their own stress, they're more likely to be able to be compassionate. And it's sort of like a muscle. You know, you can't just sit around all the time and then go out and lift weights or run a marathon. You have to practice and work up to it. So what compassion training does is it helps people practice those skills when they're calm so that they are developing that like a muscle so that when, okay, game's on, they can really, you know, do the skills effectively.
Let's bring on another caller now. Anne is with us in Oconomowoc. Anne, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on something that happened to me in my personal life and raising my children. I have three sons. And my youngest son would often react, you know, sort of in anger or sort of, you know, aggressively, you know, temper tantrum kind of reaction. And my knee-jerk reaction always as a parent was kind of, you know, the more the discipline, like, why are you doing, like how the guest had said, where he's just like, you just want them to cooperate and not cry. And I had this epiphany one day when he was just sort of having this, you know, temper. And I just, it's like this light bulb went on. And I said to him, he was probably only like 3 or 4 at the time. And I said, are you scared? And he just broke down crying, and that was it. He was scared of the situation, but he didn't know really how to handle it. And so his way of handling it was, you know, in anger or to be have a temper fit. And it just completely changed the way I parented him.
Wow. And thank you so much for sharing that story. I appreciate it, Julie.
Absolutely. And that kind of insight or those aha moments that we have are something that the parents in the compassion training often talked about, is that they just had this realization that if they could empathize with what the child was going through and then respond in that really compassionate way, like, are you afraid? That can make all the difference. And so I think that your own experience is really similar to a lot of the parents who are in this training. They realized that how they responded can make such a difference.
Well, Anne, well done on that epiphany. Thanks again for calling in. But it sounds like maybe we can train ourselves to be ready to have that kind of epiphany that Anne had.
Absolutely. I think we can take steps to do that. And whether, you know, people are interested in taking a class where it really focuses on it, or they do guided meditations and, you know, do their own sort of program, there's all sorts of ways that it can be done. Nowadays, there's so much mindfulness and meditation options and compassion training out there that I think it's easier than ever for people to get those kinds of experiences and really intentionally plan to be a more compassionate human being, which is very cool that we can do that.
And that's amazing. You made the analogy to exercise earlier. And I think everybody would accept the idea that we can improve our physical health and well-being with exercise and better food. It doesn't seem to be such a common notion that we can do the same thing with our personalities. I tend to think of myself as locked in on the personality I got.
Right, but that's not true. We can really train our emotions and how we interact with other people. We can practice those kinds of things, and we can train ourselves to do better. And when parents can do that and help themselves to respond more compassionately, they're also training their children, which is pretty remarkable.
If somebody's listening and thinking, I want to try the home version of this, are there resources out there? Can people go online and find the exercises they can try for compassion training?
Well, the particular program we used in some of them involved taking a class, but there are compassion meditations and loving kindness meditations that are available free online that people can train themselves. And the Center for Healthy Minds is just launching a program that focuses on developing mindfulness and some compassion, and that will be available to the public.
And are you looking forward to more research into the impacts of compassion and training therein?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned earlier, we're hoping to extend it to families where there are risk conditions. So, for example, I study kids with incarcerated parents, and some people are doing compassion meditation and mindfulness in jails and prisons across the country. And one of the things that hasn't been looked at yet is if that does affect the kids. And I think that would be really important to look at.
Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you again.
Julie Pailman-Tynan is the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She joins today to talk about new research looking at the impact that compassion training can have on parents and their children. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, after months of escalating tariffs and threats, the U.S. and China are trying to take the first steps to dial things down. Get the latest news on the trade and tariff tiff with China. A lot of people with mental health problems end up dealing with them in jails and prisons. Find out more with the author of the new book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. And a state lawmaker shares plans to boost support for wheelchairs in Wisconsin and to cap the price of insulin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.